Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we are back. Thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Startup Hustle Podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Conaway, founder and CEO of Innovate Her KC. Today's episode of Startup Hustle is sponsored by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. And they do a lot of cool stuff here in the Kansas City community and the world beyond. They're just a really amazing organization, but they are your one-stop shop solution. If you are trying to build something technical and you need some help, they can help you find the people, put people in the right place to help you get her done. So we do love Fullscale around these hallowed halls of Startup Hustle. So speaking of something and, well, somebody else that we love, and by we, I mean I, and by the end of today's podcast, you're going to love her too. Our guest today is one of the more fascinating individuals that I think I've ever met, because she just has a very wide birth of experience, and she's one of the smartest women I know. We have with us Nadia Igram. She is the head and attorney at Divas and Doulas, just an amazing, brilliant legal mind, compassionate human being, rock star leader, mom and friend, and just an incredible individual. And I have to tell you, Nadia, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm not sure if I can handle all those compliments.
You know how much I love you. one of my favorite people. I always leave our coffees just feeling very up, because you, in addition to being brilliant, you have just a super, you have an awesome energy about you.
Well,
thank you for sharing of your time today. And I am going to go ahead and kick us off with just the base question. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your journey. Tell us about Divas and Doulas. Whatever you'd like to tell us about, we want to hear it.
Sure. Oh, wow. I mean, it's a big question. There are a lot of things.
There are like five questions contained in that
right.
One. I think I actually asked it three different ways. So
I'll pick them all apart. That's what I do, is I pick things apart and find the little details. So,
all right.
There are a lot of things that have brought me to where I am right now. So, I think as a kid, I really, for a long time, I've wanted to be a lawyer. So that was kind of, what brought me to that point in my life was, I had always wanted to be a lawyer for whatever reason. I don't even know. Like, it wasn't something that was glorified growing up or anything like that. I didn't have a bunch of lawyers in my family. There was one cousin who was a lawyer. So I'm not sure what kind of put that in my head. But one thing that pushed that forward was I grew up in an environment where, or with parents who were very giving themselves. They were always trying to, my mom was an immigrant trying to support her family back home. And, they were always trying to help anybody. My dad was a business owner, so I come from a line of entrepreneurs as well. And even with his business, he was always trying to help people, you know, refugees who would come, immigrants who would come into the community. I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And they were always giving them jobs, trying to give them that kind of start in life to help them kind of rebuild from the life that they left. So I came from a very giving and compassionate environment, which I have always appreciated. And so that kind of pushed me forward in my legal work. I went to law school with the understanding that I was going to do some sort of public interest law or, you know, legal aid or criminal defense, you know, be a public defender or something like that. So I was always going into it with the mindset of I'm going into the legal profession with the understanding or with the goal of helping as many people as I could. It was never like, I'm going to go be this big corporate lawyer and make tons of money. I couldn't do that. I just like physically can't get myself to do any of that. And it's great. It works for some people. It doesn't work for me. So in law school, I started working for a legal aid during my last year of law school. It was the free legal aid clinic at my law school. And so I did an internship and then volunteer work with them for the entire year. And then after law school, I started working for Iowa Legal Aid in Cedar Rapids. Now, we've landed ourselves, my family and I have landed ourselves in Kansas City. We've been here for about 5 years, a little over 5 years now. And as soon as I got here, one of the things that, I mean, besides the fact that I had to take the bar exam again, so I had to do that all over again, but one of my goals was to somehow get involved with legal aid here as well. So I, at the time I had two kids, and then by the time I took my third bar exam, I was going on my third child also, which was always fun studying while pregnant and very nauseous. But after I passed the bar exam, I started to reach out to legal aid and I started to take volunteer cases with them while doing a little bit of stuff on the side. The other thing I noticed in the legal profession, coming from a background of legal aid where we don't charge our clients anything, you know, you have that one extreme of the spectrum, and then you have a lot of private attorneys who charge $250, $300 an hour, which leads to this huge gap of people who either don't qualify for legal aid because of the type of case that they have, or they're just beyond those income limits, but they also can't afford a private attorney from a private firm. And there aren't very many attorneys who do sliding scale fees. So one thing that I decided, even with my own private cases that I was taking on the side beyond my volunteer work, was that I would do a sliding scale fee to kind of help build a network or build an opportunity to be able to help those people who kind of fall within the gaps. For the doula side, and this was kind of, this came
up. Yeah, and this is the one that I'm like super fascinated by, because yeah. I'm like, attorney
right.
and doula, like yeah. two very cool professions. I don't necessarily see a ton of overlap, but I'm sure you're going to correct my perception.
No, you know what? You are mostly right. There really isn't very much overlap. The one overlap is that both are advocates for their clients, but in a different way. And this was something that I actually had to retrain my brain to do doula work for. As an attorney, you advocate on behalf of your clients. As a doula, you advocate for your clients, but you help them advocate for themselves. You know what their wishes are in their birth settings. You know what their goals are, and you recognize when maybe those goals and those wishes aren't being met or being respected, but you don't speak for them. You help them find their own voice and speak on their own behalf. Of course, if they're in a situation where they really want you to take up that initiative, you can do that, but it's a completely different type of advocacy from legal aid or from attorney work.
Also, wait a minute. I do want to drill down on that really quick, because I think that you said something really, really profound, and I want to hear your thoughts on it. So when you talk about the difference between helping people advocate for themselves versus advocating on behalf of someone, mm-hmm. what's your process like in both of those areas? Because I imagine they're very different.
Yes. So. For the legal side, when you're advocating for somebody, the lead up to that, and usually, you know, you're advocating on their behalf as you talk to opposing counsel or as you talk to the judge in a trial or in a hearing setting. The lead up to that is you're very, you know, you have to have open lines of communication between you and the client. And so the client has to, you know, it's constantly telling you, this is what I want, this is what I want, this is what I want. But you also have to be constantly reminding your client that this is what you want within the limits of the legal world, right? So you may want the sky, but a judge is only going to give you to the top of the trees. And it's constantly kind of trying to bring their expectations and their wishes down to earth, which is very difficult because the legal world, the justice system can be very frustrating for a lot of people because they want things to move at a particular pace and it's just not going to happen. They have very high expectations, and I do mostly family law. So I have folks who in a divorce or custody setting want everything or as much as they can get when the reality is they're going to get something in the middle, you know, because their soon to be ex wants the complete opposite. So it's constantly tampering down their expectations. In the birth world, your client gets free rein basically to decide what they want. You help them build their birth plan. You give them all the options of this is what, you know, an ideal birth can look like. You focus entirely on what they want and you try everything that you can to help them get that. You know, you're bound to certain limits if you're in a hospital because it has to be somewhat within hospital protocol and hospital procedure. But at the same time, you also have to tell them that, you know, as the patient, you have a lot more rights than you may realize. So you actually can reach for the sky and you don't have to bring them down to the top of the trees. You know what I mean? So it's a completely different scenario where on the one hand, you're trying to, you know, help your client realize and make them less disappointed, build them up so that they'll be less disappointed with the outcome. On the other hand, in the doula world, you're trying to help them get everything that they want, you know, to meet all of their goals and all their aspirations with their birth experience that they can realistically get. Obviously, some things happen and there are unexpected things sometimes that happen in birth. And so they recognize, you know, you help them recognize and accept that certain things may change, but you can still try to get as much of what you want as possible. So it's a very different dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. And what I love about it is that, you know, seemingly like on paper, you have two very disparate things that you're doing, but there is at least one really significant commonality. Like mm-hmm. you said, you know, it's all about advocacy. Right. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because you have always impressed me. And full disclosure, Nadia is on our IHKC leadership team. So I am, of course, a little bit biased. But one of the things that has always impressed me about you is how you have a sort of quiet strength surrounding equity and issues of social justice. Like, we've had long conversations about them, and you've just always, you're always very fact, like, you're very much an attorney when we talk about these things. You lay out the facts. You're like, this is how I feel based on the evidence presented, but you're always very, I don't want to say dispassionate because I know that's not it, but you're able to very clearly communicate some very emotional, mm-hmm. You know, and very, for some people, very triggering concepts, right? And I love that about you because I always leave feeling like so much more clear-headed. Yeah. Around topics that we discuss. Cause I'm like, oh, okay. Like now I have like some facts and now I have some info to kind of like, so kudos on that.
Thank you.
And now I'm going to actually ask my question. Cause I just like went down a whole tangent that I didn't mean to, but my question is talk to us about accessibility. Mm-hmm. I know that you have a huge heart for creating opportunity and creating access for people who have not. And that, I feel like to me, that's kind of the core of who you are. Like, that's how I see you. I'm just like, yep, she's got that servant heart and that brilliant leader brain. So let's hear about that.
Yeah. So to your earlier point, though, I will tell you that it has taken me years to kind of quiet that inner anger and inner passion, because I realized in college it wasn't going to get me very far if I was constantly like, you need to think this way and this is the reality and all that. So it took me a lot of time to kind of work on quieting that fire and getting it in a space where I can communicate in a very matter of fact and kind of, you know, sort of dispassionate, but a very, you know, easier way to digest certain information.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, like, you do a bang up job on that. I love talking, because like, well, so I'm gonna get on a soapbox for just a second here, because one of the things that drives me crazy is when people call me an angry feminist. Mm-hmm. And it's not because they're calling me an angry feminist as a pejorative, it's because, yeah, I am angry. Like, this is not new news to me, right. You know? I mean, I don't hate people who believe differently than me, but I'm angry about things that I see.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm a feminist. These are two very true words about me that you just put together and you tried to make an insult. It just doesn't work.
Like, thanks for the compliment. Let's move
on. Right. So I always, because I get really passionate when I talk about this stuff, and I always love talking to people who are able to communicate these ideas and these thoughts very, very well, you know.
Thank you. But that's also, I mean, going back to your question, I've found that to be a requirement. If I am going to be able to progress in the work that I do and making legal services, making doula services, making whatever, you know, accessible to everybody, I have some, you know, passion that comes out, but I have to make sure it's the right amount, right? Otherwise people are just going to tune out. They're going to turn me off. They're not going to listen. They're not going to be receptive of what I'm going to say. So part of, you know, taking that time to really kind of figure out how to best communicate those things has been with the ultimate goal of, okay, how can I structure how I present certain things, and how can I, adjust my dialogue and adjust the way that I speak about these things that I am deeply passionate about in a way that's going to be the most receptive, because that's going to lead to the greatest outcome. So
right.
One of the things that I studied in college was I minored in philosophy. And one thing that really struck with me was utilitarianism, because I have always kind of operated under the belief that I personally, and I think, you know, generally people should do this, but I understand that most people don't, but I personally will make decisions and do things and structure my work in a way that benefits the greatest amount of people. You know, I regardless of what it is, even in my personal life, the way I raise my kids, I raise them in a way that is, you know, making sure that they're going to be full functioning, compassionate, kind members of society who are aware of all these social justice issues. I mean, my son was talking about redlining the other day, and he's 7. And I was just
that's
kind of
amazing. And that does not at all surprise me, but that's amazing.
But I was just like, you are 7 and a half, and I didn't learn about redlining until I was an adult. So I, you know, it goes back to, you know, with accessibility, I function in worlds, especially the legal profession, where it is meant to be exclusive to in a lot of ways. You know, you have people who are constantly looking for self-help forms and really questioning whether they need a lawyer. They do need a lawyer, but they can't afford it. And because we've created an industry where people think that it's inaccessible, they don't understand what legal jargon means, but they don't want to, you know, have to run to the bank and drain their savings to pay for a lawyer for something that shouldn't cost that much. They shouldn't have to pay thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for an advocate for them in a system that's built to make it so that they can't understand and therefore need that advocate. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, one thing that we're not even taught in law school, which also doesn't make sense, is how to talk to your clients in a layperson way. We use all kinds of words that most people don't understand. You know, doctors have bedside manner classes. We don't have that in the legal world. And that's one thing that I've, you know, really found too, that has to change. I haven't yet gotten there. That's on my list of things to do. I haven't gotten to that point yet, but I think that should also be a required class for law school. Like, you have to know how to talk to your clients in a way that they can understand so that they don't feel so distanced from the legal world. I mean, there's thrust in it for one reason or another, especially with divorce. You have no choice but to go through the legal system.
Right.
You have to go through a judge to get a divorce. You just have to, there's no way around it. But why then make it so that they can't understand what's happening? You know, you talk on behalf of your client because the legal system has been designed so that client can understand, so that the lawyer has job security and to a large extent. And I don't think that's, you know, I don't think that's the best way to operate personally. So what I try to do is I do a sliding scale fee. You know, I encourage my clients that could go to legal aid to go to legal aid, and then come back to me if they don't get through for one reason or another. I have quite a few clients who come to me because I'm one of the very few Muslim lawyers in this community. So they want somebody who has that religious understanding, that cultural understanding as well. And so same thing with, you know, my doula services. It's a sliding scale. I work with other nonprofit doula organizations in Kansas City because I think that is a necessary service, just like it's a necessary service to go to any doctor. Doulas scientifically have been proven to reduce labor length, reduce the number of interventions, have you know, better chance of a great outcome and better bonding with the parents and the baby. So I think that's a service that should be accessible to anybody who wants it. And right. not because we're also not.
Well, and who doesn't want more support? Like, right. So I have never, you know, gone through childbirth, but I can imagine that it's probably a scary process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's painful and you have all of these doctors like around you doing things that you might not understand. And so just having like somebody in the room who understands what you're going through, who can help advocate for you when you're too tired. You know, I imagine that that would just be a huge comfort in addition to all of the tangible benefits that you're listing, you know?
I can tell you, I went with my third child. There was a point where both my husband had gone out of the room to get something, and my sister-in-law, who's always been my kind of unofficial doula, had left the room for some reason. And I was alone for one contraction. And I swear to you, I was the biggest baby. I was like, I can't do this alone by myself. Get back in here. So I can't.
Oh, God.
I can't imagine. Like, there are people who have to go through the entire process alone. And that shouldn't be anybody's reality. I mean, I'm a pretty, you know, physically, like, I can handle a lot of pain. And that one contraction about broke me. And I was like, I can't do it anymore by myself.
Yeah.
So that's definitely.
So, like, in a perfect world, would every person who delivered it, like every woman or every person who delivered a baby, would have a doula?
Yes, and that's culturally, that used to be the norm for so many places around the world. That's the thing.
Yeah,
where we lost it here. We don't have that support. I mean, in other places in the world, you go into labor and there's immediately somebody there who's experienced, who knows what to do, is helping you through that. Here,
right?
We've become such an individualistic, you know, society that we've lost our village, both during, you know, the prenatal period, where you don't necessarily have somebody to help get you ready for the birth, but especially during labor and delivery and postpartum. You know, we're expected to go back to work. If you're lucky, you get 6 weeks unpaid vacation. Most people don't even get that. Right. And that, you know, where your body needs so much longer than 6 weeks to recover from a birth, having a newborn, if you choose to nurse, then, you know, getting used to all of that, then all of a sudden you have to switch to pumping. I mean, it's not conducive to healthy relationships. It's not conducive, you know, between parents and their children, but it's also not conducive to healing. And, you know, people who have had a baby have to have time to heal physically and mentally and emotionally. And we don't have. So yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we could have a whole show on, inequities in labor and delivery, mm-hmm. and family practice here in the U.S. and the ways that we fall short. But I'm very grateful that there are people out there like you who are working so hard to address these barriers. You're doing amazing work. And speaking of doing amazing work, really quick, I have to pop in here and I have to let y'all know that this episode of Startup Hustle was sponsored by Full Scale. We love Full Scale. They actually have a whole amazing team ready to help you get developers and get the team that you need in place easily, quickly, affordably, so that you can build your tech product and so you don't have to worry about it. And they're there to take the stress and the worry out of the equation for you. And I love that about them. So for the folks listening at home, if you are looking to build an app or software or whatever it is you need to build, Full Scale is definitely your way to do that. So we went down like a whole tangent that, of course, is like, it's all shiny for me. Like, I want to talk about it, but really what I want to get to, because I really want the folks who are listening to this podcast, like, I really hope that they take away the need to bridge accessibility gaps for their customers, for their community. Like, I don't really care what it is, but I think that, like, if you approach things through a design thinking lens, through that empathic problem solving methodology, which I'm a huge advocate for, you know, you build things that will benefit the most people, and in particular, you build things that will benefit the vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Because that way everybody can access, the vulnerable can access, and then the people who are, you know, abled or, you know, fit into the paradigm, well, it also works for them. It's like a win-win-win. So talk to us about, you have such an amazing heart, and I love the way that you explain this. So talk to us about the accessibility gap and I'm going to say in our country, and knowing that Startup Hustle is we're listened to in a lot of different countries, like hi Iceland, Ireland, Albania. Apparently we do very well there. I didn't know that until recently, but it's super cool. Hi. We love y'all. Keep listening. But for folks who might not be in the know, talk to us about some of those systemic barriers that people experience.
Sure. So first of all, hi to everybody around the world. Now I'm a little bit nervous. I didn't realize I was so global.
Yeah, apparently we're like number 4 in entrepreneurship podcasts in Albania. And I remember like Matt sent out a text and I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. That's amazing.
That's incredible. So there are, this in and of itself, like just this one question is a whole another hour, but I'll try to condense it. So, and just kind of pick on a few things. So there are quite a few systemic factors that lead to this. And one of them, I think one of the biggest ones, especially now we're seeing with COVID, is the lack of accessibility to some sort of internet access, right? Whether that's, you know, Wi-Fi, broadband, whatever it is. I don't even understand the whole internet world. All I know is, you know, we have Wi-Fi and my husband sets it up because he's the IT guy in the family. But the simple...
Yeah. Well, and here in the States, we call that the digital divide.
Right. So,
the haves and exactly. have-nots.
So we've seen... with especially with everything going virtual, and I've seen this in the courts as well, people who don't have regular internet access, they don't have it at their homes, they don't necessarily have access to it at their work, they can't, their kids can't attend school, virtual school, because they just don't have. I mean, some schools have tried to bridge that gap by sending out, you know, routers and Wi-Fi hotspots and stuff like that, but those are also spotty sometimes. They don't work properly. But for something like that, that's also not a requirement for the court system. So courts have gone virtual almost exclusively. Some are starting to come back in person. I did have an in-person trial the other day, a couple weeks ago. But for the most part, courts are still virtual. And if you have a client who's low income, who doesn't have internet access, and I have had clients have this problem, how do they attend their hearing if they can't connect? Some courts have given, you know, a call-in number, but I've also had judges say, you know, judges, clerks tell me, no, there is no call-in option. They have to appear by video. Okay, but if they don't have internet access, or if they don't have a smartphone with a camera, because a lot of these folks also don't have laptops or computers at home, how on earth are they supposed to be expected to attend virtual court? And then if they don't attend, they could potentially have some sort of, you know, judgment against them. I mean, in a civil case, you know, you could lose your custody battle simply because you don't show up to court. I mean, I don't know if there have been cases that have landed in that extreme, but it's certainly a possibility when you don't have that regular access because of the digital divide. In other ones as well, there is just, like I mentioned before, with the legal availability of legal services, access to legal services. For lower income individuals, you know, there are legal aids, but legal aids have a limited scope of the types of cases that they can have. And even with that limited scope, they have an even more limited scope of the availability of staff to take those cases. So when I used to work at legal aid, we had to sit down every week and go through all the cases that we had done intakes for. And so that's assuming you get past the intake process, which means it's a case that you can handle and you're within the income limits. At that point, then we have to go through and say, okay, we can take this case, you can take this case, but we can't take this, you know, half dozen other cases because we simply don't have the staff and the resources to do it. So when you don't have enough funding to hire the adequate amount of staff, and I know public defenders are even worse off than legal aides when it comes to the availability of funding and staff, you have so many people who simply can't get the help that they need. So if you can't get a public defender, or if you get a public defender who is so tapped out because they have extreme caseload, then you're ultimately going to have a higher risk of a worse outcome, whether that's a public defender or legal aid or whatever it is, if you can even have access to that attorney. On the legal aid side, if you don't even have access to that attorney because let's say you're within the income limits, but it's not that type of case, you're out of luck because you're not going to find an attorney, or at least very many, that do a sliding scale fee and would be willing to take that case. On the birth end, for lower income individuals, or folks without healthcare, because, you know, access to healthcare is not it's not a given in this country, unfortunately.
Yeah, for those of you listening in countries with universal healthcare, way to go, y'all. We're just over here.
Jelly. It's a huge problem. You know, and even if you're among the few that has somewhat affordable healthcare, right? Because then you have no access to healthcare, you have access to healthcare, but it's not affordable. You have access to somewhat affordable healthcare, but it doesn't cover everything. Doulas are not covered by most insurance. Right. So the accessibility to that simple service is gone completely for a lot of people, because we're not, you know, most doulas aren't free. Pretty much no doulas are free unless it's a nonprofit doula organization.
Well, I should have to give that. I mean, you definitely deserve paid for your amazing services.
I'm certainly not saying that, you know, all lawyers, all doulas, all professionals should offer free services. Rather, those services should be accessible, because you have to uplift the communities that can't access them. So you run into issues of education. Okay, well, part of the reason why a lot of these communities can't access those services is because they weren't given the same opportunities because of particular areas that they live in, or because of their socioeconomic community, or because of their race. Let's be real. You know, certain races have, in this country, have a lot less access to quality education, because our education system is based on a system that rewards the wealthy. You know, if you get to better schools because you pay higher property taxes, because more those schools get more funding, that's not a reality in a lot of
ways. Guess who tends to pay, you know, be able to pay higher property taxes?
Guess who? The wealth divide is also a real thing. Yeah. You know, so I have family in Canada, and they're like, no, our schools aren't, they don't get, you know, funding based on property taxes. That's crazy. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. It is. But that's how we do it here.
I know. I like, honestly, like there are some days where I'm just like, America? Like I love America. And I just not too long ago did a show with someone who was not originally from here. Actually, Nomi Smith, who you might know. She's amazing, but she comes to us from Mongolia, and like she really, like, when she was talking, she was like, you know, America, it's still like, even with all its problems, it's still a land of opportunity. And like, you know, she made me feel like, very, like, I love America, but sometimes I do also want to smack America. I feel like it's like having a child where like, I love you so much.
I love you, but I don't like you in this moment right now.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm well aware that we have issues, but fundamentally, I love my country, but because I love my country so much, I expect better of it.
So
that's kind of where we're at, but I'm just like, you know, some of these things that you're, like, telling me, like, they don't make it make sense, America. Make it make sense.
I think if we really want to live up to the, you know, belief that we're the land of opportunity, then we actually have to make it so that everybody has the same opportunity to succeed. And we don't have that yet. There are a lot of people who are working towards that. There are a lot of forces that are working against that. But I think if we keep pushing, if we have enough of us who keep pushing, because the you know, in certain ways, things are a lot better than they were 20, 30 years ago. So, you know, some things haven't progressed as quickly. I tend to get impatient. I'm like, change now.
You know? I know. Well, and so for me, like, the reason I get impatient is because people are often telling me, well, you just have to be patient. You have to wait for people to catch up. You know, only a few years ago, this was unacceptable, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, every moment that we wait is a moment that someone, a human being, a real person, but in most cases, many, many, many human beings get left behind. And so by being patient, we allow that. And so I like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I get it. Like, I understand what you're telling me. And like, you have to bring people around. Like, to your point, like, you're a master of bringing people around because of your communication style and the way that you approach your work. And I love that. But at the same time, I'm just like, no, I want to be impatient. Like, I want to push it, push it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And a lot of people have been being patient for hundreds of years, and they still haven't seen the change that they deserve. So, you know, there has to be, it's fine to be patient to an extent. I mean, I know in the legal world, in the court system, I have to be patient because it moves so slow.
Yeah, you've got patience locked up.
But to the broader community, I think we're running out of patience, and that's okay too, because we waited so long. So many people have, I mean, I've waited long growing up here, being born and raised here, but I know, you know, friends of mine and communities of color that have waited hundreds of years to get the rights that they deserve and to have access to all of these things that we're talking about. So, and they just haven't gotten it. So, I mean, I'm perfectly fine with running out of patience at this point, because sometimes when you run out of patience too, it pushes more people faster. And so you have to, it pushes things forward that have to be addressed right away, because it is, for a lot of people, it is a matter of life and death. It's a matter of freedom and liberty, or, you know, something else. It's a matter of gaining opportunity or continuing to be held back. And, you know, we can't bridge any of these accessibility gaps if we don't recognize that we have to open up certain doors for certain communities that have been closed to them for so many years. And it's time to just bust the door down, so that they can actually have access to those things.
Yeah. Well, I want to take that a step further with you, because one of the things that I talk about on a regular, and I think we've actually talked about this before. And I invite anybody listening, like, come have a coffee with me and Nadia, if you want to see like some really impassioned people talk about some awesome shit. But, so one of the things that we talk about around IHKC circles is the difference what is equity versus equality. And so when you are trying to open doors for communities that have heretofore not had access, there's this idea out there that you cannot give everyone the same stuff and have them end up in the same place. If you have people who are already like economically disadvantaged, educationally disadvantaged, people who have been denied access and opportunity for centuries, you know, that it continually compounds, and you add trauma and you add all of these things, you cannot give them the same things that you would give someone who comes from a historically affluent, white, cisgender, you know, like abled lineage. Like you just can't do that and expect them to end up in the same place. And so you have to give additional tools, resources, learning in order to make up the lost ground, right? Am I explaining that well?
Absolutely. Like, because you have individuals who, you know, you have, like you said, white, cis individuals who are starting at the starting line. And you have folks who are starting, you know, 100 feet behind the starting line. If you give each group of people 10 seconds to finish the race, because that's equality, those people at the starting line are going to finish a lot faster than the other, you know, the other folks in the back of the line aren't going to finish at all. I mean, I just came up with this analogy in my head while you're talking. So let's see if it works. But let's look at let's make it human, right? Let's look at a pot of boiling water. Let's say you want to make some pasta, okay? If you start one pot on it high and the other pot that has the same amount of water on it low, and after 5 minutes, you pour the pasta into both pots because that one pot's boiling already, that pasta's not going to get done at the same time.
Yeah.
It's not. The one in the not boiling water is not. It's just going to get nasty at that point.
It's just, you're just going to have some hard, you know, hard pasta.
So what you're going to have to do is crank that other pot up higher. You're going to have to give it a boost, because it's never going to be able to catch up to the pot of boiling pasta that's done after 8 or 9 minutes and is perfectly al dente, right? It's not going to happen. You're not going to end up with the same. Giving people the equal opportunity, the equal amount of tools, is not necessarily going to lead them to the equal outcome. It's just not going to happen. When you have groups, huge groups of people, large communities that are already lack, you know, the same amount of privilege, they lack the resources, they don't have the access to education that, you know, the other side has, they don't have access to all of these things. I mean, if you look at Kansas City, I live in Waldo, and the streets around here have finally gotten repaved, and they're gorgeous, right? They're so smooth. You can finally drive on a lot of them without busting a tire every time you hit a pothole. But go a little bit east. Go on 85th Street and go east of Prospect, let's say, even east of Troost. All of a sudden, the potholes are there. Everywhere on the east side, maybe not everywhere, I haven't been everywhere, but in a lot of places on the east side, there are tons of potholes. It seems like a simple thing, right? Like, what do potholes matter? But what ends up happening is, what a lot of people don't recognize is that compounding effect. So that pothole means somebody is going to be driving to work who probably already works, you know, multiple jobs, because there's lesser, you know, economic opportunity on that side, because that was intentional with redlining, right?
And they're playing like pothole Frogger, like across the road. And so for those of you who don't know, Kansas City, we have a pothole problem across our city. It's being addressed. But I know it is, but we have a lot of potholes.
It's not being addressed in an equitable fashion. That's what's frustrating. Because then you have that person who hits a pothole, busts a tire. Well, that's going to set them out, you know, a couple hundred dollars. They don't have that couple hundred dollars to spare. So then they can't get to work.
And they're not going to be able to go. They might miss work. They certainly have to miss work to go get it fixed. They have to pay for the tire and the labor. And so you've created a, you've created a gap.
Compounding problems that have, very potentially detrimental outcome. And we don't look that far ahead.
So the one that I always use is like, if you were to give, or let's say that you gave a $5,000 scholarship to two individuals, to college. And so on the one hand, you have someone who came from a less advantaged community, didn't have a whole lot of resources in their schools or anything like that. And then you have someone who came from a highly resourced community. And it's like, well, cool. You gave both of them the same scholarship. That's amazing. Congratulations. But the person who comes from the advantaged community isn't going to have to worry about books and probably isn't going to have to take on a job to pay for room and board and isn't going to have to scramble to come up with the additional monies for school without taking on loans. So you have given equal opportunity, but you have still propagated a deep gap. In opportunity.
And a lot of people combat that with, it's not, well, it's, giving somebody more isn't fair. Okay, but the underlying problems weren't fair. The underlying inequities weren't fair.
Right. So we're actually going to run long here, but I love it. So I want to ask you this question. What are some ways, like some really tangible ways, or maybe even it's just sharing a way of thinking? Like if you could give advice to our listeners with the understanding that a lot of them are founders, they want to start businesses or they're in the thick of, leading businesses, what would you tell them to decrease accessibility gaps for the folks they serve, whether it's their family, their community, their customers? Yeah. Like I don't care. But what would you tell them? And this is going to have to be very general advice. And I understand that.
So I think there are a few things. Like I can't ask everybody to do a sliding scale because that doesn't also work with a lot of industries. Yeah. It works for me. But that wouldn't be one of my pieces of advice for most people. What I would say is first you have to adjust your thinking, and it takes a lot. It takes a lot to really deconstruct your brain and kind of reanalyze and reassess the way that we were taught in school. And the things that we were led to believe that aren't necessarily reality, right? So adjust your way of thinking and also recognize what your privileges are. That's one thing that has, on a personal level, has really kind of propelled me to do as much as I can, because I do recognize that, my parents had to work hard for what they had, for sure. But I also, by virtue of my background, my race, my religion, all of that, my socioeconomic status, my ability to get the education that I've had, I come with a lot of privilege. And so I have to recognize that, accept that within myself, be content with that. I mean, it doesn't mean that you're inherently bad by any means. It just means you're recognizing where you've had advantages that other people have not. And then use that to help others. And the way that other, business owners and companies can do that as well in terms of bridging the accessibility gap is there are a few different things. If you're a bigger company, you can certainly hire, a DEI, a diversity, equity, and inclusion officer, but it has to be somebody that, has experienced somebody who can speak on behalf of disadvantaged communities, but also somebody who is actually going to implement the right types of policies that need to be implemented. And then the leadership of that company has to be open to it. That's kind of the biggest thing, that a lot of people hire a DEI officer as like a surface thing to make it look like they're doing the work, but they're not really doing the work, So it has to be intentional and you have to be committed to it, whether it's somebody staff or you bring in a consultant,
I always tell people that true equity always takes more time, money, resources, and people and words. It also takes more words. So for those listening at home, when we're talking about these things, I think it's really important to note that, to Nadia's earlier point, we I don't think anybody is expecting people to give services away for free. But like, for instance, so Matt DeCourcy, he's one of our Startup Hustle hosts, and he is founder of Full Scale, our episode sponsor. But like, he doesn't give services away for free, but he does create like every now and again, he'll take part in a competition where he'll donate services. I know that he mentors a lot of founders, like to share knowledge and help them out. And so like, there are a lot of different ways that you can plug in to closing some of these accessibility gaps and ensuring that whatever product or service or, you know, revolutionary cool thing you're doing, there are ways to make sure that the highest number of people can access it. And I think that that's the point. You know, you don't have to give everything away, but just make sure that you're looking with a view to create democratizing mm-hmm. access. That's the phrase that I use a lot.
Try to find it within your budget to give back in some way, whether it's offering those free services, supporting a local organization that helps provide those services for free. There are so many creative ways that can be done.
Absolutely. Well, and so speaking of Matt, I would be very remiss if I did not mention that this episode of Startup Hustle was sponsored by Fullscale.io. And in addition to doing great work in the community, they also can help you build a software team quickly and affordably. Did you like how I did
like
that?
Nice segue. It was very clever.
Totally unintentional. Also want to mention, you know, I don't know if you heard it. And Nadia, did you know that we actually started a TV show about entrepreneurship? Have you heard of this yet?
Startup Hustle TV. I saw something Startup about Hustle it. Yeah, TV? Yeah, I did. That's interesting.
Oh my gosh, it's so much fun. So if you head on over to YouTube, you can search for Startup Hustle. You can watch me and some fellow founder cast members. I cuss a lot, so I would like to apologize in advance, but that's just kind of what I do. But you can watch us, and we share the real story of our journeys as entrepreneurs, and I just love it. So definitely keep an eye out for that. So Nadia, I have a question.
I'm ready.
For you. Are you ready? Here it comes. So you mm-hmm. talk about your kids.
Don't ask me which one's my favorite, Lauren.
You are I'm not going to ask you which one's your favorite. I would never do. Well, I mean, I might do that at like a coffee, be like, but I'm not going to do that here today. I'm going to say that you have a full day, money is no object, with your kids, with your family. I guess your husband can come if he wants to. But what do you do?
Day, no money. Money isn't an object, and I go anywhere.
Money isn't an object. Even if you wanted to go somewhere, like you can go. You just have to remember that.
Yeah,
you know,
one
you have
day.
A day.
Okay, I only can only do it in one day, so it has to be close. All right, I would go. I would take the kids. I would let each of them pick one place that they want to go to. Their favorite place within a couple hours distance, because we have to be able to get there on time. So sure. I would let them each pick one place that they want to go to. And it could be like Wonderscope. It could be Science City. It can be whatever their favorite museum is. We would go to that. We would then go maybe for like a couple hours of just like relaxing on, you know, in the woods or something like that, you know, find some nice like lake area where we just chill. I think that would be awesome. And then I would maybe drop them off with a babysitter and go have a night with my husband.
Good for you. Well, and I love the fact that like on the front, you're loading the front end, like you, even in your family life, you're democratizing the experience. You're just like, hey, everybody gets a say. And I'm just like, that's so Nadia. But yeah, well, so I have to tell you, my friend, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. I always have fun with you. I knew that this was going to be a fun one.
For having me.
But you rock. I think you're awesome.
You're even more awesome. You're incredible. Always a pleasure hanging out with you. Always.
Heck no. Yes, same. Okay, all right. We're going to stop with the Mutual Admiration Society. No, I'm going to take it one step further, and I'm going to say, you know who else we love, dear listeners? We love you. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to give us a listen here at Startup Hustle Podcast, and we will catch you on the flip side.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.
We do it.